From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Saul Austerlitz is my guest. His work has been published in the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, Rolling Stone, and tons of other places. He's the author of Money for Nothing, a history of the music video from the Beatles to the White Stripes. His new book is another ambitious chronicle covering roughly 100 years. It's called Another Fine Mess, a history of American film comedy. Saul Austerlitz, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I love your book. It's a great read, and I think any film fan will enjoy it. And I guess it's also maybe a teeny tiny bit opinionated. And so if you don't mind, can we begin with a little quibbling?
Absolutely. I love quibbling.
I was hoping you'd say that. So in your introduction, you say that you don't have room for everyone. So I guess that means that, you know, we shouldn't expect a chapter on Grady Sutton or Joe Penner. But Katharine Hepburn gets a chapter, and Bob Hope gets like two paragraphs. Katharine Hepburn, she's a renowned dramatic actress, great comic timing, and your chapter about her is really well written, and I'm glad you wrote it. But at the same time, Bob Hope, you know, he was an influential comedy star, was in like 80 movies. From the 30s to the 60s, why does Katharine Hepburn get a chapter and Bob Hope doesn't?
Well, your quibbling is definitely well noted. And in fact, Bob Hope was one of the people that I had initially considered devoting an entire chapter to and ended up cutting sort of at the last minute. In part, I think the reason was because he didn't feel like he tied in strongly enough with some of the other people I was talking about. And in that sense, it's much more a failing on my part than anything negative about Bob Hope, who I think is extremely funny. I would say, though, that in terms of his career, there were definitely some high points, but there were also a lot of low points. I think a lot of Bob Hope's work is not necessarily worth looking at or you know, worth studying in great detail. That said, you know, some of his better work, like My Favorite Brunette, is terrific, and I wish I had more space or devoted more space to looking at him, and especially, you know, considering the sort of influence he had on later figures like Woody Allen. He's worth reconsideration. I feel like a lot of younger people, younger comedy fans, only know Bob Hope as the sort of stodgy old guy who hosted the Oscars, and there's a lot more to him than that.
He did, you know, I mean, there's no denying that he did some crap and that he walked through his television specials for the last, you know, 30 years of his life. But as you say, there's some great things there, too. So let me just ask you then, you know, some of the people that you talk about in your book, and I think it's great that you do, are not people we think of as comedians. You know, I think of Dustin Hoffman or Cary Grant as great actors, but I, you know, particularly think of them as comedians. What made you decide to picture them that way?
Well, that was very intentional. I felt like it was important to widen the scope of what we think about when we think about American comedy, because I feel like too often the concept of American comedy is limited to people like Chaplin and Buster Keaton and all their descendants, and I obviously love all of those people and have nothing negative to say about any of them, but there's a comic vein in American film history that gets left out, and it includes people that you'd never think of as being particularly funny. I think that the person that I mentioned in the book who's gotten the most sort of quizzical responses is John Wayne, because people think of John Wayne as, you know, the sort of paragon of Westerns and Mr. America and whatever else. But John Wayne also made all sorts of funny films with John Ford and with other directors, had a wonderful sense of comic timing, and to me is sort of an exemplar of that particular brand of kind of hidden comedy that was made not by comic stars and not by comic directors, and yet is very funny and you know, worth thinking about in the context of the American film comedy. And, you know, I think the same is true of people today like Quentin Tarantino, who we think of as being, you know, an action director or an indie director or whatever the case may be, but is also clearly a comic filmmaker, you know, someone who has a real gift for comedy. And so it was important to me to make sure that people like them didn't get left out of the conversation, because I feel like they definitely belong there.
Oh, and I applaud that. Although, you know, John Wayne didn't get his own chapter, but I'm very happy that Doris Day did. I mean, I think now people are suddenly sort of paying a little bit more attention to Doris Day. We've done a couple of shows about her here. She really was a fine actress.
She was, and she was also very funny, and I feel like some of her films, you know, especially the ones with Rock Hudson, have this terrible reputation as being sort of the epitome of, you know, pre-sex Hollywood, basically, you know, where everyone slept in separate beds and all that. But there's something extremely charming and sophisticated about those movies, you know, movies like Lover Come Back, and in some ways Doris Day has become kind of a walking punchline, and it was important to me to sort of try to resuscitate her reputation, to actually look at the films rather than, you know, this sort of pre-existing concept of Doris Day as the eternal virgin.
I love that scene where she drives through a car wash and the top comes down. She's I can't remember what picture that is. What is that? Move Over, Darling, or one of those?
I think so, yeah.
She's great. But you must have had some fun watching some films. You must have watched about 10,000 films to prepare for this book.
Oh, I watched, you know, more movies than anyone should be exposed to. But for me, it was a pleasure, and I got to see all sorts of things that I'd never seen before, and obviously lots of films that I'd already seen and loved. And so for me, it was just a chance to really fully immerse myself in the past and present of the American comedy and really get a sense of it. And obviously there are an infinite amount of films that I haven't seen and that I didn't have room to include in the book. But, you know, hopefully I got enough of it to sort of give the flavor of it and at least get people started with a sense of where to begin and then, you know, to take it from there.
What's your personal, what's your generation's comedy? I don't know how old you are. So how old are you, by the way?
I'm 33.
33. So your Saturday Night Live is older than you.
Sure. I mean, it continues on through yeah. me and beyond, but
Yeah, that's interesting. So so what were the things that you first laughed at when you were a kid?
I remember loving the movie Three Amigos, which was on TV all the time when I was a kid. It's, again, a movie that has a terrible reputation, but
it's
I don't know whether it's just because I have a soft spot for it from having grown up on it or loving Steve Martin. But to me, it's still a really funny movie, even though it's obviously a pretty mediocre one as well. And then later on, you know, people like Mike Myers and Jim Carrey were sort of the big movie stars when I was growing up and, you know, in high school. And they, I guess in some sense, they sort of set the sensibility for me. But eventually, I mean, I would say that the sort of preeminent comic filmmaker of the generation and the one of the people who really got me thinking about comedy as a tradition was Wes Anderson, whose movies I think are just brilliant. And I think in some ways do reflect back in interesting ways on what came before him.
In what way?
In the sense that his movies are obviously very self-contained, you know, they're sort of these perfect little jewels that he's created, you know, in order for us to appreciate them. But I do think that in terms of the comic sensibility, in terms of the self-deprecation, in terms of the sort of silly and bittersweet characters, there is a sort of connection with the screwball comedy and with the kinds of characters and settings we associate with, you know, movies that Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn used to make together, like Bringing Up Baby or Holiday or films like that. And obviously with the very contemporary sensibility that comes out of the American New Wave and, you know, indie Hollywood and you know, a more modern era as well.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you also about Lorne Michaels. Right in the early part of your book, you mentioned Lorne Michaels, and I guess I really hadn't even considered, because I just think of him as a television guy, you know, the incredible influence that that guy had on movies in the last 35 years.
Yeah, I thought it was sort of a stray thought that came to me, but I thought it was one that was worth considering, just in the sense that even if we remove from the equation any of the films he actually made as a producer or as a screenwriter, you know, just by virtue of working as a sort of talent scout for the movies, he's had an incredible track record in essentially finding or making, you know, I would say the majority of the comic stars of the last 30 years.
all
so
the stars
alone,
of all the stars of Three Amigos, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. And continuing on, you know, into more recent times with people like Mike Myers and Will Ferrell and even Tina Fey, you know, he's had an absolutely remarkable record of sort of finding one comic wizard after another.
And, you know, who would have ever thought that sketches from Saturday Night Live would make not only interesting feature films, but, you know, hugely hit feature films?
Yeah, definitely. Although for, you know, every film like Wayne's World, there's another one like
Coneheads.
Superstar or Coneheads, exactly, which, you know, is of a lesser variety, I guess.
Yeah. We're talking with Saul Austerlitz, and his new book is called Another Fine Mess, A History of American Film Comedy. I liked your chapter on W.C. Fields a lot. I teach a film course, and I showed It's a Gift to a group of students recently, and they just stared at it as though it were in Swahili. But I think it's brilliant, and so do you.
I love It's a Gift.
Why do you think today's generation doesn't really know W.C. Fields that well?
I think in part it might be because he's so off-putting. He's so not like the kind of cuddly movie stars that we're used to today that I wonder if maybe some people who haven't been exposed to his films before are just sort of don't get what the humor is. You know, he just seems like this bad guy, I guess. But, I mean, to me, he's astonishingly funny. And part of what's so funny about what he does is his willingness to be the jerk, you know, to kind of be this unpleasant, raw, nasty guy. I always think of, you know, from It's a Gift, him kind of going toe-to-toe with this baby that he's taken a dislike to. You know, he's out there like that.
Yes. But now, in your chapter about W.C. Fields, you dissed Edgar Bergen, who I also happen to think is a comic genius, but that's okay. That's all right. You have your taste, and I have mine.
Well, I don't mind Edgar Bergen so much, but in that particular movie, I feel like they're just sort of two different worlds colliding, and it doesn't ever really make sense what he's doing in that movie.
Let's talk a little bit about Jerry Lewis while we're talking about people who people today don't really get.
Yes.
Jerry Lewis, you know, he was like a superstar of amazing proportions, and now, you know, people don't really think of him, they don't like him. What's the story?
Well, I feel like he's another former giant star who's become his own punchline, you know, in the sense that what people know about Jerry Lewis is either he's big in France, which seems to have become a joke for some reason, or, you know, the telethons that he does. And his work has sort of gotten lost in the mix. People don't really see his movies anymore. And when they do, they sometimes, you know, they're often seeing the wrong ones. And he's, I see the ways in which he could be an acquired taste in the sense that he sort of plays these odd babyish characters and is kind of off-putting in that sense. But again, to me, I mean, I think that he is the inspiration for so many of the man-child characters that we see in comedy today. You know, he really created that in some sense. And his gift for physical comedy, especially in a movie like The Bellboy, I mean, it's, you know, Jerry Lewis always wanted to be Chaplin, and I guess he didn't ever really become quite that brilliant, but you can really see the ways in which he's, in some senses, Chaplin's successor as just a incredibly gifted physical comic.
I think he could have made a silent film that probably would have been pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at a film like The Bellboy, which in some ways is a lot more avant-garde than everything that he does afterwards as a director, it essentially is a silent film. His character doesn't really speak.
Mm-hmm.
All of the lines that other characters deliver are basically unimportant and have no bearing on understanding or watching the film. I mean, in some ways, I think of The Bellboy as being the American equivalent of Jacques Tati's brilliant movie Playtime, which is also a movie that essentially only has, you know, gobbledygook for dialogue and is, you know, a modern silent film.
On the other hand, Mel Brooks actually made a silent film.
He did. It's not quite at the same level, however.
You're not a fan of that picture. It's not a, good movie.
You know, I'm pretty explicit in the book about not being the world's biggest fan of Mel Brooks. I don't dislike his work necessarily, but I don't think it's quite that good. And that, you know, a movie like Silent Movie is sort of the epitome of that. It's a great idea. It's a genius idea. It's just the execution is not all there.
Well, I can tell in your book that you really admire the early directors like Lubitsch and Preston Sturges.
Yes.
What about Woody Allen? I mean, he's a guy who's obviously influenced by all those people. His career has gone through several phases. He continuously works. What do you think?
I'm a big admirer of Woody Allen, and I always have been. I think that just the sheer virtuosity of his career, the different stages that he's gone through and the different kinds of films he's made, you know, people forget by virtue of him being so virtuosic and making so many movies how much he's done, in the sense of beginning as this sort of broad comic filmmaker in movies like Take the Money and Run and Sleeper, you know, going through the most celebrated phase of Annie Hall in Manhattan, the 1980s movies, which are very, you know, sort of his own takes on European art films. You know, I'm thinking about movies like Purple Rose of Cairo and eventually Crimes and Misdemeanors, and even after that, where his audience sort of falls off a cliff, you know, up until this past year in Midnight in Paris, he still made pretty interesting films, you know, movies like Match Point or Bullets Over Broadway. You know, he makes so many movies that I think people sometimes only remember the mediocre ones, at least from the last 20 years or so, but he has a very impressive, you know, baker's dozen of movies that you can put out there as being, you know, as deep a roster of films as any other comic filmmaker I can really think of.
And you're a fan of Wilder. Which are your favorites of Billy Wilder's films?
Well, you know, Some Like It Hot is obviously the one that people always think of first, and it's a brilliant movie. I happen to love the slightly more bittersweet ones. I think The Apartment is a classic. And I also have a real fondness for his Italian romantic adventure from the 1970s, Avanti, also with Jack Lemmon. I think that Wilder and Lemmon were a terrific comic team. And in some ways, Avanti, which comes near the end of Wilder's career, I think might be one of their best.
Interesting. And because as I'm reading your book, you're kind of moving along in a chronological way. And then when you get to Wilder, suddenly we jump, you know, kind of into the 60s. I guess because Wilder, you know, had a long career that lasted from the 40s to the 60s. But
yeah.
Who are some people in the middle there that maybe you didn't get to that you would talk about in Volume 2?
Well, I think that, you know, if I had infinite space, I probably would have devoted more time to a director from the 1950s like Frank Tashlin, who I think was a very interesting figure, had a big role in Jerry Lewis's early career, worked with other stars like Jane Mansfield. You know, Tashlin had begun as a comic, you know, drawing a comic strip, and you can really feel the ways in which he's sort of adapting the tradition and style of the comic strip into movies. And so his movies are very, you know, sort of bang, boom, pow, and they really feel like you know, you're reading an old school comic strip. And, you know, to me, he's a very interesting figure, and his movies are very crass and loud and very funny and not really what we might think of today as being a sort of 1950s film. So I wish I had had more space to devote to him. You know, in some senses, some of the people who get left out, or at least, you know, don't have a full chapter devoted to them in the book, in part it's because they sort of get included elsewhere. So, you know, by virtue of devoting a whole chapter to Jerry Lewis, someone like Tashlin sort of gets swallowed up in that as well, by, you know, since they work together. But I wish I had been able to delve into his career a bit more deeply.
Right. Well, your chapter on Katharine Hepburn is also about Spencer Tracy, and
exactly.
You're Cary Grant is also about Leo McCarey and so forth.
Right, and writing about Woody Allen, you know, I only get to discuss briefly some of the actors who work with him, people like Diane Keaton and Mia Farrow, who are, you know, worthy of consideration as being, you know, comic actors in their own right.
Well, you know, an interesting thing about the Three Stooges, who just write a small entry in your book. The Three Stooges, I don't think, were very popular in their prime, you know, in the years that they were making their 190-some shorts. But now the Three Stooges are incredibly popular. All of their shorts have been released, and they continue to sell. They re-release them a million different ways. What do you think is happening? Why are the Three Stooges so much more popular now than they were then?
I don't know. That's a good question. You know, I think that there is a perpetual taste for that kind of lowest common denominator of physical comedy. And I don't mean to slight it by any means. That's, you know, that is something that has a very long and rich tradition in American comedy. To me personally, the Three Stooges are not tremendously exciting just because when you've seen one of their movies, you've sort of seen them all. There's not a ton of variation. You know, I'm thinking about earlier silent stars like Chaplin, like Keaton, like Harold Lloyd, who obviously also had a certain shtick and repeated it, but they managed to create an infinite amount of varieties on a single theme, you know, creating one character and then putting them through all these different possibilities. Whereas with the Three Stooges, it's the same idea, but in the actual production, you get the feeling like they're just beating each other over the head constantly, or at least I do. And so for me, they're funny, but I don't feel the need to revisit their films over and over.
Let me ask you about Marilyn Monroe. Oh, I want to tell everybody that we're talking with Saul Austerlitz, and his book is called Another Fine Mess, A History of American Film Comedy. You know, I mean, there's some people who are funny because they're in a comedy that's well-written and well-directed. What elevates Marilyn Monroe from just that category?
I think that sometimes she's underrated by virtue of everything that we know about her personal life and about some of the struggles she had. I think she either becomes this eternal ditz, you know, someone who didn't know the first thing about acting and was just sort of an accidental star, or she becomes this tragic heroine, you know, pushed around by these stronger men, you know, whatever the sort of mythology that people are most interested in. But to me, I feel like what gets lost in that is the work itself, the films she actually made, and the likelihood of someone like her just accidentally winding up in so many of these terrific films felt very unlikely to me. And it felt like it was doing a disservice to her to turn her into either of those things, to, you know, this ditz or this tragic heroine. And so for me, it was most interesting and most rewarding to really go back into the films and see what she did there. And I think that it doesn't mean that, you know, it's worthwhile to ignore completely some of the stories about her always forgetting her lines or coming late to the set, or, you know, some of the really funny Billy Wilder one-liners about working with her and how miserable it was. But I did feel like there was a hard core of comic talent that was there and worth discussing in more detail. I also felt like, and in some senses this was a problem I inherited, but, you know, comedy, American film comedy, is such a male tradition, you know, so overwhelmingly male. There are so few female comic stars or directors. It felt important to me to sort of highlight the ones who had kind of made it through to the other side.
I guess that's part of the film industry in general, not just comedies, but...
Well, in some senses, you know, I feel like it's a distinction that's worth making between film and television, because I'm actually working on a book right now about American sitcoms, sort of a follow-up to this one. Mm. And one of the interesting things about it is that there are so many more great female comic stars on television than there really were on film. And in thinking about it, I'm sort of wondering if maybe one of the reasons for that was because television was so much more of an intimate medium. You know, television was something you watched in your home with your family. You sort of invited the characters in to spend time with you. And I wonder if by virtue of that intimacy, audiences didn't feel somewhat more comfortable with female stars, you know, with people like Lucille Ball and Mary Tyler Moore and Roseanne, than maybe they would have as larger-than-life film stars.
Well, I want to hear all about that book when it's ready. You're working on that now?
Yes.
And will you come back to From the Bookshelf and
Absolutely,
talk about that?
Absolutely, if you'll have me.
Are you kidding? No, I'll be waiting to quibble with you.
I'm looking forward to
about
it already.
Why Joan Davis does not get her own chapter in your book. Really, what's up with that? Okay, maybe she does. I'm jumping to conclusions. Gail Storm gets one. Eve Arden, no doubt. She's got a chapter.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Everyone you might want is going to have a chapter.
All right, good. The book that we're talking about now that I want you all to go get right now is called Another Fine Mess, A History of American Film Comedy. The author is Saul Austerlitz. He's also the author of Money for Nothing, A History of the Music Video from the Beatles to the White Stripes. Thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Well, that closes the book on this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. The production of From the Bookshelf is aided and abetted by Francis Venegas. Thanks for all your help, Francis. I want to thank Saul Austerlitz for being my guest. His new book is called Another Fine Mess, A History of American Film Comedy. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.